This is the Medicast, March 26th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 59. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to thank all of you for picking up this podcast. For those of you that have been listening for a long time, I want to congratulate you on helping out with the show and making the Medicast the fine piece of podcasting that it is, if I do say so myself. And for those of you that are brand new listeners, I want to welcome you to the podcast and welcome you to the website. Visit medicast.com for a lot of information, links to everything I talk about in the podcast, and also a lot of other stories that I put up there in blog posts throughout the week that have to do with EMS and medicine in general. And you'll also see quite a few comments that have come up over the last weeks from listeners and people that view the website and other bloggers that have been commenting on some of the things that have been discussed. There's been quite a few things that have been batted around in discussion over the last week, and you can see what has been going on by heading over to the Medicast site, either on my blog, on Peter Canning's blog over at medicscribe.blogspot.com, and also at Eric's blog over at the EMS Haiku blog, and there's links to all of that on the website, so you can see what they've been talking about. We've been discussing a couple of things regarding airway management, regarding the great classes that we saw over at the GEMS EMS Today conference a couple weeks ago, and just some things that have been going on in EMS news lately, and I don't think I need to cover that here, so head over to the website and check that out. And again, welcome for the brand new listeners to the podcast. I'm going to lead off with some listener mail right now, and the first piece of mail I got in was from Wyth over at the iHeart EMS blog. She does a great blog, and she's going to be representing all of us in Washington, D.C. here coming up in a month or so. And so she had some questions. She's in the middle of medic school right now and had some questions on if anybody knew of any good pharmacology practice problem sites. And she said she's getting bored working over the same ones over and over again and was looking for something else to help her study and be prepared. And with, you know, I appreciate that you're doing that. I think you're probably squared away. If you've got a couple of different books and things you've been going over, you're probably squared away for all the drug calculations you're ever going to need to do. But I will point you at a textbook that I know about, and it is a book called Dimensional Analysis for Medication Pharmacology. I think that's the title. But if you look up dimensional analysis and pharmacology and search those terms, you'll probably turn up. It sounds very complex. Basically, what the book really focuses on is setting up your problem right to begin with, getting all the terms in the right order. And if you learn how to do that, which they do in the very beginning of the book, everything else, the rest of the book, is cake. I mean, really, it tells you how it wants to be set up, and if you learn to set the problems up the way that they show you how to, you can calculate any drug dosage, any drip rate, anything you need to calculate, and it all fits into the equation the way they show you how to set it up. You learn one way of doing things, and everything else is just a question of plugging and playing. So I want to thank Wyth for making that comment, but I am going to put the call out to you guys. I mean, we got over 1,000 listeners out there listening to the Medicast. So this is a call to action for all of you. Call to action. What I would like to see is if we have anybody out there that has a good website with some pharmacology problems, because you know what? Wyth's not the only one that has this question. So let's get some emails in here to podmedic@mac.com, or you can head over to Wyth's iHeart EMS blog. There's a link to that blog in the show notes as well, and a link to her on the website. And let us all know what you guys use for your pharmacology practice problems. I got a voicemail comment in from Mark, and Mark is a firefighter paramedic in Los Angeles, and he is participating right now, along with some other services in his area and local hospitals, in a stroke care study involving mag sulfate. But I'll let Mark talk about that himself.
This is firefighter Mark. I work with the LA County Fire Department, and I was listening to one of your medic casts, and you're talking about strokes, and you're going to have an upcoming discussion on it. And I don't know if you heard, but out here in Los Angeles County, we're actually doing a study on magnesium sulfate and how it might help with stroke patients. We have certain area hospitals that are going to be stroke centers that have come on board with the study that we're actually doing. It's University of California, Los Angeles is putting on the study and using the larger area fire departments to do this study, which includes LA County and City of Los Angeles Fire Department. And we, our paramedic squads or ambulances are carrying this drug, mag sulfate. Now, it might be the drug or it might be the placebo drug. We don't know, but we have to put our patients through a LAPS assessment, basically a head-to-toe approach, determining neurodeficits deficits and whether or not they're bedridden or in a wheelchair, which would actually take them out of the study. We're also doing a blood sugar check, and if it's between, like, 70 and I think 400, then we can do the study on them. But just thought I'd let you know, since you're going to be talking about strokes in the future.
Mark, thank you very much for your comments and information on that study. That's really fascinating, and I'm going to be interested in seeing what comes out of that, because mag sulfate does have effects on seizure activity, and I would be interested to see what effects it has on the brain during a stroke. Well, without further ado, let's jump right on into this week's news. Now, I've got to start off with this first story, and I know it's I'm going to be a little tongue-in-cheek about it, but it really is a quite serious issue. But with all the drugs we carry around in the ambulance with us already, is it really necessary to transport 400 pounds of pot in the back of your ambulance? I mean, come on. All right, this happened down in Texas, and apparently an ambulance down there was pulled over and stopped when investigators found nearly 400 pounds of marijuana stuffed into the ambulance. The police there said that they found the drugs after the ambulance had broken down near a gas station. And an individual saw something that just didn't look right, and they called some people in and found out that there was a paramedic who was in the area who was being brought up on suspicion of drug charges. I guess it's suspicion because he hasn't been actually officially found guilty yet, but good grief, 400 pounds of pot in the back of the ambulance. Does that count as a bariatric patient? I don't know. Anyway, it's something that just really caught my eye. I can't imagine what was going on, but apparently it had a street value of over $500,000 and is the largest drug bust in this town's history. I'm looking at the article here. It looks like it happened in Arkansas, even though I got the link out of a Texas news website, and apparently the ambulance came from Texas. So needless to say, I just have to shake my head when I see things like this. In the next item, I've talked about the National Association of EMTs before. They are our representatives in Washington and do a great deal of lobbying and educating of our people on Capitol Hill and in the federal government about what we do in the field and what we need from them legislatively in the field. But they've also produced a video that has been released that will be used as a public service announcement. And it's a great opportunity for us to educate our public. In their press release, they say most Americans take it for granted that when they call 911, a trained emergency medical professional will arrive to help them. But they don't understand that we need their help in spreading the word about the importance of EMS. And this is a great thing because they include a call to action that says people can do things like become an emergency medical technician. They can remember to pull over when the ambulance comes, they can learn CPR, and they can talk to their elected officials to support us. This is all great stuff. Here's a little bit of that promo.
When you call 911, you want a trained emergency medical professional to take care of you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Emergency Medical Services is a community effort. That's why we want you to join our team. Consider becoming an emergency medical technician. Pull over when an ambulance is approaching. Learn CPR. Urge your elected officials to support Emergency Medical Services. Together, we can save lives.
There it is, a great little 30-second promo. And the audio is pretty good by itself, but there's some good video that goes along with it. So head on over to the website. There's a link in the show notes to the NAEMT website, or you can head over to naemt.org, and there are links right there that'll help you find that. I believe you can get a copy of it sent to you, and you can try to get your local cable service, your local TV stations, to maybe put it into their public service announcement rotation. It's a great way to educate our public about the things that we do. I found a study listed over at the Medical News Today website that talked about the effects of quitting smoking and the long-term healing that goes on after you quit smoking. We see COPD patients all the time, and we know that COPD, once it starts, it really is a progressive disease and there's no going back. We can't cure COPD. We can just lessen the effects of its symptoms. But up until the point when you've done permanent damage to your lungs, there's been pretty good evidence that you can heal your lungs, that your lungs will return to a certain level of health after you've quit smoking. And that's been pretty well documented. What hasn't been documented is the other effects that smoking has, especially on the stiffness of your arteries and the long-term vasoconstriction caused by nicotine and other drugs in cigarette smoke. What this study has done is really looked at the effects of smoking cessation or quitting smoking on long-term healing of the arteries. How elastic do they become after you quit smoking? What they found was that up to about a year after you quit, there really is very little difference between the elasticity of your arteries and between yourself as a one-year quitting smoker and a smoker currently smoking. However, after that time frame, there is a continuous progression of healing that occurs. And out to about 10 years, once you get to that point where you've quit for 10 years, you have the elasticity return that would be the same as a person who does not smoke. And that's good to know. We need to be telling people that quitting smoking, once you do it, it can have long-term health effects and really improve your quality of life all the way around. Finally, I'd like to talk about some advances that I found in a news item related to a new drug delivery system, or advances in an existing drug delivery system, I guess, and that is transmucosal drug delivery. Now, we already do this in the field. We do nitro under the tongue. That's transmucosal. Oral glucose is transmucosal. Even a rectal administration of Valium or other benzos during a seizing child's epileptic seizure, we all see that, and that's transmucosal. It's delivering a drug through the mucous membranes where it is readily absorbed into the bloodstream and transferred that way. What they say in this particular article is that transmucosal delivery is really becoming something they're looking at as a worldwide solution to medication administration and drug compliance. And one of the reasons is they've been able to make some significant advances in how they make the drugs more soluble, how they improve what they call mucoadhesion, or the ability of the drugs to stay where you put them so that you don't swallow them and they become orally administered. That reduces the effectiveness markedly. So if you want to make sure that it's staying where you put it so that you can have it administered safely. And also that they've improved the ability to make the mucous membranes more permeable. All of these things have made transmucosal drug delivery something that we could really see a lot more of. And we may see more medications administered this way. Already people are administering drugs like Narcan intranasally through a nasal spray. And again, we see this in nitroglycerin, oral glucose, and rectal administration of Valium. We may see more and more of our medications being administered this way. So it'll be something to keep an eye on, and just something I wanted to kind of keep everybody aware of. Well, the news is done, and it's time to jump now into this week's tip and trick of the week. It's a tip and trick of the week that I've covered before, way back in episode 14, and you can check that out if you want to over at the website. But it's something I think that needs to be revisited often, and that is the subject of pain management in the field. Now, this is something we all talk about all the time. It's something that we as paramedics discuss, we as EMTs discuss. It's something that is near and dear to our hearts because, quite frankly, I don't think we have enough ability to control pain in the field as far as what we're allowed to do in many cases. Now, I know some of you are going to disagree with that. Some of you have really great relationships with your medical control and are able to get orders to work better at controlling pain, but it's something we all need to be aware of and really advocates for, because there's no excuse in this day and age for having a patient be in a significant amount of pain for any length of time. And there's some really good reasons not to do it medically. It inhibits healing. It inhibits the patient's ability to experience pain in other episodes later in life. It just all carries on down through the patient's continuing care. Now, there's an article over at Emergency Medical Services at EMSResponder.com that I get some of the information for this article from. And one of the reasons that I point to this article is because they have a goal in this article, and I think this is a really admirable goal for all of us to have, and that is to deliver all of our patients to the hospital pain-free. You know, if the doctor wants to replicate pain, they can go ahead and give a patient Narcan and remove the effects of the morphine we've given them so that they can see if they really had abdominal pain or not. This is how ridiculous the arguments against us administering pain meds in the field. But it doesn't just go to the paramedics and the ALS providers out there. It behooves all of us to be on top of managing pain, and there's some very simple ways we can do that. But let's look at pain itself first. Physical pain is not a disease in and of itself. It is a symptom, and many call it a vital sign. It is the missing vital sign. How often do you include pain in your assessment when you take vital signs? Every single time you take vitals, you should be including a pain assessment. I firmly believe that when you're getting your pulse, respirations, blood pressure, pupils, whatever it is you're including in this, you need to include pain was at a level of 2 and where that pain was and description of that pain. Pain is the reason people call us most of the time. They will ignore a lot of things. They will ignore the bleeding cut on their arm sometimes, but if it hurts them like the Dickens, they're going to call us. The reason we have pain is to warn us not to do something. This is the reason our body tells us we're in pain. It tells us to take our hand out of the hot water. It tells us to get away from the fire because it's burning us. But when we deal with pain in the field as medical providers, there's no good reason for a patient to experience pain beyond the point where they tell us, hey, I'm in pain. And so we need to do all we can to alleviate that pain. So what is pain? Pain is the activation of our central nervous system by peripheral receptors to tell us that there's something wrong. In the simplest sense, it is our body telling us that we have something broken. And when this happens, our brain responds by trying to remove the body part that's in pain from pain if it can. What this means for us long term is the longer we have pain, the stronger the body's response is to that pain. And the issue becomes that people who have had their pain treated sooner in the field or sooner after the onset of pain have less pain further down the road in that treatment course. And in fact, will have less of a reaction to pain in future episodes where they have painful stimulus. On the other side of that coin, People who have had a painful episode and have been undertreated for that pain or not treated at all for that pain for an extended period of time often experience a more painful and more extended recovery and healing period, and their future responses to pain are heightened. So why do we need to heal people's pain and take care of pain in the field more quickly? Very simply, it improves their long-term outcome, and it improves their ability to handle pain in the future. There are four main types of pain that are listed in this article. And the first one is somatic pain. This is the pain that's sensed in our peripheral tissues, our external tissues like our skin, our muscles, our bones. And this is what you feel when you have a cut or you break a bone. This is somatic pain. Visceral pain occurs when we have pain or damage to our internal organs. And these internal organs have different types of receptors, and we have a different type of pain associated with it. Kidney stones, irritable bowel, some kind of bowel blockage or GI problem are all episodes of visceral pain. Neuropathic pain is a difficult one to get your finger on, but it really has to do with a problem in the nervous system and in the way it transmits pain. It also can be something that can be triggered by people who have experienced long-term chronic pain, like back pain or other things. Think about it, people who have pinched a nerve. It's hard to treat sometimes, especially with some of the opiate drugs we have, but it may respond to some of our drugs that are maybe sedation type drugs. And then there's breakthrough pain. And this is pain where people who already are under pain medication and pain management have a sudden increase in pain that breaks through the pain management they have. And this might be seen in patients like cancer patients or patients that have a long-term chronic illness where their pain is just not being managed at that particular moment by the drugs they're already on. And yet this pain also needs to be treated. Pain is typically undertreated in our service, and I think some of it has to revolve around the myth of the drug seeker. We don't want to treat the 99% of our patients who have true pain because 1% of our patients might be just trying to get high. And, you know, when you think about it, that's a really sick way to think about treating medical problems. And it's not our job to determine whether somebody is a drug seeker or not. They may really be having pain. They may be a drug addict, but they may have fallen down and bruised their kidneys, and they're having real pain, and we need to be able to provide treatment for that. So I really think that this myth of the drug seeker, while it is true that we run into people like that, it doesn't do a service to the rest of our patients that really, really need pain management. Another reason we undertreat pain in the field has to do with the way our standing orders are written. Many of us have standing orders to administer morphine or other pain management medications for peripheral injuries, but require us to call for medical consultation for any pain centrally, pain in the chest, pain in the abdomen, pain in the head. All of these things are non-peripheral pain and require us to consult medically. The mistake we make, I think, is that we assume that we're going to have to consult. We're not going to get orders for what we need to treat this pain, or the doctor's not going to give us the orders and we're going to feel like idiots for calling. This is a mistake. And we need to educate ourselves. We need to talk to our physicians about it, ask them what they want to hear about when we call in, really work together, become part of the team, and invite them to become part of your team. And say, look, doc, what do I do when I have a patient with abdominal pain? They're in agony. I'd really like to be able to give them something to knock that pain down. Here's the thing. When they get to the hospital, I guarantee you one of the first things the nurses are going to ask for and they're going to get orders for is pain management and pain medication. So we need to be stepping up to the bat and telling them, hey, we need pain management for this patient. Give them the picture, paint it for them. Doc, I got this guy doubled over. I can't keep him buckled into my stretcher. He's holding his stomach. He's in agony. I really need to give him something. Here are his vital signs. Here is his pain level. Here's where his pain's located. I'd like permission to administer 4 milligrams of morphine, and I'd like to be able to administer in a follow-up dose of 4 milligrams if that doesn't take care of it, and an additional dose in the back just in case I need it. Tell the doctor what you want. Be firm, be assertive. And you might not get everything you ask for, but they're going to give you something most likely. And you can reserve the right to call back and ask for more management. So give them the drugs you've asked for. And 2 minutes later, if they're still not having any solution to this problem, then go ahead and call back in and ask for permission to administer more. You know what? The doctor's going to get the picture that this didn't cover it. They know that morphine isn't going to do what they want to do with a low dose. You're just going to take the edge off. Well, maybe it didn't do the trick. You need to be able to get back on there and ask for more. So don't be afraid to do that. There's also other things we can do besides deliver just opiates. We do have morphine, which has been used for many, many years in the field. We also have fentanyl, which is another newer version of a newer opioid analgesic. Like morphine, it does the same type of things. It does have the CNS depressant action and will reduce the respiratory drive. But you know what? We've got Narcan. We can take care of those things. So be aware of that. There's also other medications out there, some of them available for BLS providers like nitrous oxide. And we can't forget things like oxygen delivery. High-flow oxygen has been found to provide pain relief to people with headache issues, migraines, things like that. So if you have somebody with an intense headache, administer high-flow oxygen to them. Ask them to deep breathe. Help them to relax. These are all things that are BLS procedures. Lower the lights in your ambulance. Do things. Talk to your driver about driving on a highway rather than on the back road you usually take to the hospital. If you add 5 minutes to your trip, but you get the patient there without hitting as many bumps when they've got back pain or they've got a fracture, this is a way you can alleviate pain. And it's not a drug delivery system. Use your ice packs, folks. Use your heat packs if somebody has muscular or back pain. Sometimes heat can alleviate some of those pains, especially if it's related to muscle tightness. All of these things are simple interventions. So if you're not going to get orders for medications or you're a BLS provider, there are things you can do in the field. But I'll tell you this, don't be afraid to call for an ALS intervention. If you've got a longer transport to the hospital and you've got an ALS unit that can meet you en route, ask them if they can meet you, upgrade, and let's get some kind of narcotic on board to help treat the patient that's in a significant amount of pain. Don't be afraid to ask that ALS provider to get in there and upgrade your unit. Oh yeah, just because it's a broken arm. Well, you know what? Broken arms hurt like heck. And there's no reason to just release that to a BLS provider simply because you don't feel like riding to the hospital right then. If pain management is indicated and that is an ALS thing, then go ahead and administer ALS pain management. So that's my little talk on pain management. You can tell I feel very strongly about it. If you head over and look at a lot of other sites out there that deal with EMS, Peter Canning's site is a prime example. He talks about pain management all the time. And I got to agree with him. You know, we don't do it enough. And we need to get out there and start becoming advocates for our patients. In a similar vein, the med of the week this week is going to be a pain management drug. And it's one I talked about a few minutes ago. Nitrous oxide. Now, nitrous oxide is not a medication that I have as a provider in the state of Maryland, but I do know that there's a great many providers in this country and around the world that use nitrous oxide as a pain management medication. And in many cases, it is used as a BLS intervention, which I think is fantastic. Nitrous oxide is a short-acting inhalation sedative analgesic agent. It was discovered a long time ago. We know it as laughing gas. It's been used by dentists for years before they came up with other sedative agents and other local anesthetics. This was used for a long time to help people get through painful procedures. So what do I mean by ultra short acting or an inhalation drug? Well, it's a 50% mix of nitrous oxide and oxygen, delivered via a sealable mask that is held to the face and is administered by the patient themselves. So that's why this is considered a BLS drug. If the patient can hold the mask to their face and seal it, it will be drawn in by the action of them taking a breath. In other words, the valve is a sealed valve that opens under negative pressure by the person taking a breath, and it releases a 50% mix of oxygen and nitrous oxide. The medication only lasts for about 2 to 5 minutes. It has an onset of action of 2 to 5 minutes and a duration of 2 to 5 minutes. And this means that if the person gets a little bit too much in their system, if they can't hold the mask to their face anymore, they'll be breathing natural atmospheric air, and they will be giving them, they will get themselves reoxygenated. It is a central nervous system depressant. It dulls the senses and blunts perception of painful stimulus, and it can create laughing gas. It's a carefree attitude, according to the article that I found, about one's surroundings. It will be short-acting in the system, and so it can be a great indicated pain relief medication for temporary out-of-hospital pain. It's going to be used pretty much exclusively for peripheral pain management, though. Things like burns, things like broken bones, bruises, contusions, and things like that. And the reason this is because nitrogen gas can be trapped in body tissues. It is one of those things. Nitrogen is able to diffuse very easily across membranes in the body and can be bubbling into trapped air spaces. And it takes the body a long time to get that nitrogen out of there. So anytime we have any suspicion of things like a pneumothorax or some kind of a bowel obstruction where they might swallow some of the air and the nitrogen could be trapped in the bowels and cause that bubble to cause more pain and obstruction problems, we're not going to probably be using this medication. In fact, in some situations, and I'll just look at some indications I found online here, nitrous oxide is indicated for orthopedic trauma, soft tissue injury, suspected fractures. It may also be indicated in patients that are having things like kidney stones or peripheral burns or abdominal pain that is not suspected to be related to a bowel obstruction. Contraindications would be any kind of head injury with altered level of consciousness, ingestion of alcohol or drugs, facial injuries or trauma, thoracic trauma, because again, we don't want to be exacerbating a pneumothorax by having nitrogen gas trapped in the chest. Any kind of suspected cardiac ischemia or cardiac ischemic chest pain. Patients that may have any kind of respiratory distress or onset of cyanosis during the delivery of this medication would mean that you would want to discontinue its use. You would also want to make sure that the patient is able to comply with the instructions. Again, this is going to be a self-administered drug. So if the patient is no longer able to provide a mask seal to draw that breath and create that negative pressure to open the valve, then they can't use the medication. And that's one of those things. If we're depressing the nervous system to the point that they can't hold the mask to their mouth, they don't need any more nitrous oxide. You also want to continuously monitor pulse oximetry and monitor the patient's respiratory rate and respiratory quality. You want to make sure that they're breathing effectively and making sure that their lungs are clear. You're going to continuously deliver nitrous oxide because it is metabolized and used up quickly. And you want to make sure that your cylinders, because this is a compressed gas, you want to make sure your cylinders are stored safely and securely so that in case of an accident or a sudden turn that the cylinder doesn't get dislodged and cause problems. You want to check your pressure levels on your cylinders, make sure that they are the correct cylinder. And when administered in an ambulance, you want to make sure you have your exhaust fans on. We don't want to get everybody else happy and silly on the nitrous oxide. So there may be some leakage from the cylinder or leakage from around the mask, and we want to make sure that we're venting the inside of the ambulance quite frequently to take care of that. You want to make sure you document, just like any other pain medication, you want to document the pain level before, you want to document the pain level after administration, and you want to document how often and how long the patient used the particular drug delivery system. So again, you want to just monitor all of these things and administer the nitrous oxide safely. You want to look for some adverse effects. It's very safe medication in general, but again, you want to watch for signs of air entrapped in a closed space. So you want to monitor for pneumothorax. You want to monitor for an increase in abdominal pain, which may be indicated by trapped air in the abdominal or GI tract. You want to make sure that you protect against leakage of the gas into the passenger compartment. And of course, again, remind you again to make sure that your exhaust fans are on when using this particular medication. So that's about it for this week's Med of the Week, nitrous oxide, a drug that I don't use personally in the field, but one that I'm intrigued by because I think it would be great for us to have an option for BLS treatment of minor injuries, medically speaking, but nonetheless painful injuries. And this would be an opportunity for us to provide people with some kind of a BLS pain treatment beyond just giving them cold or heat packs or administering oxygen and positioning to treat that injury. So this is something new for me, and I thought you all might like to learn about it too in case your system doesn't use it, nitrous oxide. And that is going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the show and sharing all your questions and comments. And it is really important for me to make this as much of a community effort as possible. It's one of the reasons that I put together the MedicCast Live call-in show once a month, and the reason that I really try to answer all the emails I get. Even if I don't talk about it on the show, you can reach me here, and I will try to get back to you right away with an answer if I know it. And if I don't, I'll do what I did with comment tonight. I brought it up on the show and asked you guys to give me some information on that. So, you know, this is what we do. This is why I try to get this out there. I think it's important for us to share information with each other so that we can all become better providers. You can reach me here at the MedicCast at podmedic@mac.com. And you can also check out the website over at www.mediccast.com. And over there on the blog, you can leave comments over there as well. There have been a lot of great comments from listener Chris, from Blue Ridge Medic, from Peter Canning, from a bunch of other people. Really just a great ongoing discussion about several issues over the past couple of weeks. And you can participate in that as well by heading over to the blog and leaving a comment on any of the postings over there. Great opportunity for all of us to share more together. There are other ways you can reach me here at the show, most notably by the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. So if you're driving along listening to the show right now and you'd like to comment on something you heard in today's episode, go ahead and call in at 941-30-MEDIC and leave a message. And maybe you'll get your message played back on the next episode of the MedicCast. I try to reach and get back to all of you. Please leave your email address at the very end. I will clip it out so that it doesn't go out, but at least I can get back to you by email if I have any further questions about your comment. If you want to get more information and know what's going on at the MedicCast, then I urge you to sign up for the MedicCast newsletter. There's a link in the top of the website on the right-hand side. You'll see a link that says free MedicCast newsletter here. Click on that link, fill out the quick little web form, and send that in, and you'll get a confirmation email back, and you'll need to click a link in there to verify that you are who you say you are, so I'm not spamming anybody. And you can sign up for the MedicCast newsletter. Every week when I send out the show, you'll get a list of links, just like the show notes have, so you can click right in there if you have any questions, a link back to the show notes webpage, and also a special newsletter only tip and trick of the week. A short little tip that I like to throw in there for the newsletter listeners that are signing up over there at the website. So if you want to get more information on that, go on over and sign up for the MedicCast newsletter. It's a great way for you to stay in touch with what the MedicCast is doing. You can also check out the Medicast News midweek. I usually do a short 5 to 6 minute newscast on a few items that might fall through the cracks during the middle of the week. You can find that over at the Podcaster News Network or at MedicCastNews.com. And there's a link on the main Medicast site to that when I post that up as well. But another great little podcast for you to get some things midweek that you might be missing. And, of course, the Medicast Live podcast, the monthly podcast, where it's an opportunity for all of us to get in and talk together and have a phone-in show where you guys can participate in the topic of the month. And the next one will be coming up on April 10th at 10 p.m. Eastern time, and it'll be an opportunity for everybody to call in. And we're going to be talking about pre-hospital stroke care and stroke care centers at our local hospitals. So a great opportunity for us to learn a little bit about what a stroke care center is, what kind of things they have to do to qualify for that designation, and what we can do in the field to treat our stroke patients better and get them to the proper definitive care they need. All of that can be done over at the Medicast Live website. Head on over to TalkShoe.com, register for a free account, and then you can be ready for the next Medicast Live, and I'd like to talk with you guys live there at the next episode on April 10th. Finally, the best way you can support the show is tell everybody else that you know about this show and all the other great podcasts you listen to. Whether it's entertainment, whether it's informational, whether it's educational, podcasts are a great way to find targeted information on topics that we all care about and enjoy listening about. So I urge you to share that with your friends. And as always, thanks for supporting the advertisers on the website, clicking on those links there to find out more about what they're talking about. All those things help support the Medicast. Before I wrap out the show with some music, I want to send out a great and hearty congratulations to John Bignell and his wife, Kelly. Kelly gave birth to an 8-pound baby boy a couple days ago, and I hope that they remain safe and healthy and that John is able to get some sleep because, hey, John, as a new dad, you're about to find out what sleeplessness is all about. But we want to keep you all in our thoughts and prayers, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about how you all are doing, and I just wish you all the best. So from all of the Medicast listeners, from myself and from my family, to yours, congratulations to the Bignell family. John Bignell from EMS Live. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. Tonight comes from the IOTA PromoNet site, a great site that supports independent labels from around the world. And tonight's song is a bluesy number in honor of our night of pain management and pain management medications, a song by an artist by the name of Linwood Slim, You're a Pain. Until next week, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene Safety, BSI.
You're a pain, pretty baby. That's part of your charm. You're a pain, pretty baby. That's part of your charm. I'd love you, darling, if you right or wrong. I take you here, there, everywhere. I even watch your hair, your pain, pretty baby. That's part of your charm. Yes, I love you, darling, if you're right or wrong. I fix your cars, I fix them good. Spend half my life underneath your hood. Your pain, pretty baby, that's part of your charm. I love you, darling, if you're right or wrong. I say where to, you tell me public storage number 32. You're a pain, pretty baby, that's part of your charm. I love you, darling, if you're right or wrong.
way it's got to be. It don't matter, you're the girl for me. You're a pain, pretty baby, that's part of your charm. I love you, darling, if you're right or wrong. I can take anything that you can dish out. You're my girl, there's no doubt. You're a pain, pretty baby, yes, that's part of your charm. I love you, darling, if you're right or wrong. If you're right or wrong.